Convene the August 2012 regular meeting of the Forest Practices Board. My name is Lenny Young, and following Bridget Moran's leaving DNR to join U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I'm going to be chairing the meeting today on behalf of Peter Goldmark, Commissioner of Public Lands. I'm his designee for this meeting. And so, first order of business, I'd like to have the board members introduce themselves, starting with Jacqueline.
Jacqueline Ford, designee for WSD.
Bob Gunther, small forest landowners.
Good morning. My name is Bill Little. I am a board member for the Forest Practice, Forest Industry Unions.
Dave Summers, Snohomish County Council, representing counties.
Paula Sweeney, general public member.
Mark Calhoun, designee for Department of Commerce.
Morning, everybody. Tom Lorraine, designee for Department of Ecology.
Good morning. I'm Dave Guerrero, general public member.
Bill Davis, general public member.
Carmen Smith, contract water representative.
Dave Whipple, designee for Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Norm Schoff, general public member.
And Patricia, can I call upon you for the safety briefing this morning?
Good morning. In the event of a fire, alarms will sound and flash. Please leave this room using the double doors in the front of the room. In the event of an earthquake, alarms may not sound and flash. Please drop to the floor and cover your head as best as you can or go under a table. After the shaking has stopped, leave this room using the double doors in the front of the room. And in the event of any evacuation of the building, staff will lead you out of the building using these doors, double doors in the front, and then the first door on the left, leading you out towards the parking lot along Washington Street. The door out to the left where the scaffolding is only to be used in the event of an emergency. Once outside, DNR employees are trained and equipped to assist you in checking in and responding to emergency. This time, I ask that you silence any noise-making devices, please.
Board members, do you have any questions for Patricia as to safety procedures? Okay, there being no questions, we'll move on to the next agenda item, and that is approval of minutes from the May 8th, 2012 meeting.
I would move that we approve the minutes.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion to approve the minutes of the May 8th, 2012 meeting, properly seconded. Any discussion around the minutes? Patricia? Mr. Gunther moved the moved, and Mr. Davis seconded.
Thank you.
Okay, seeing no discussion, we'll take a vote on that. All in favor of approving the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? And I'm going to abstain on that vote because I have no knowledge of the May 2012 meeting.
I was not able to attend that meeting.
Okay, so we have 11 yeas, no nays, and two abstentions. And next item on our agenda is a short report from the chair. First thing I'd like to do this morning is introduce that we have designated a new deputy supervisor for Forest Practices and Federal Relations. Aaron, would you stand and be recognized?
Good morning.
So Aaron Everett is our new deputy supervisor, and he'll be taking over supervision of the Forest Practices Program on this Thursday, August 16th. So welcome, Aaron. It's great to have you.
Thanks.
Next thing I wanted to note is you'll be hearing more about this later in the agenda, but to note that in May, there was a successful resolution to threaten litigation around the Forest Practices HCP. A lot of hard work on the part of many parties led to a settlement agreement among the Conservation Caucus, Washington Forest Protection Association in the state, and averted that threatened litigation. So we'll be hearing more about that later today. And then the last bit of housekeeping for this morning, I wanted to note that we will soon be submitting a report on adaptive management program reform on behalf of the Commissioner of Public Lands and the Director of the Department of Ecology to the legislature. This is really nothing new. This is a summary of all items that the board is familiar with, and we'll be turning that in on 1st of September. This is an agenda item for Forest and Fish Policies meeting on Thursday of this week, And so there would be the opportunity for caucuses to dialogue if any of the content is comment worthy. Darren, anything you'd like to add on what's going to take place at policy on Thursday?
Okay.
So any questions on that report that we're going to be turning into the legislature first of September? Again, this is a routine report required as part of a budget proviso from last session. So with that, I'll conclude the chair's report and we'll move along to public comment. And this is the time for public comment on general topics. And so would you please limit your comments to a maximum of 3 minutes, and we'll be watching the clock to make sure that we get this agenda item dealt with and that everybody has a chance to speak. At this time, we have 6 people signed up for comment. So first comment, Sean Cantrell. Morning, Sean.
Good morning. Good morning, board members, chair. I'm Sean Cantrell. I'm the executive director with Seattle Audubon. For some of you, I'm a familiar face showing up here. For others, it's the first time I've met you, so thank you. I'm pleased to see on your agenda today, there's a significant segment titled Northern Spotted Owl Recovery. Forest Practice Board has important responsibilities regarding the conservation of the threatened owl on non-federal lands here in Washington. Previous chair, Bridget, had spoken multiple times about the idea of forming a subcommittee of the board to look at these issues and to identify what next steps, if any, the board should take regarding additional activities to protect owls and help with the recovery here in Washington. The federal recovery plan that was issued over a year ago now does also specifically call out for states, including Washington, to review all of your management activities and regulations and incentives and everything else that you may be doing to see if they're appropriate and adequate to meet the current needs of the owl. So with all of that, I urge you to take swift action. I'm really pleased to see that it is on the agenda. You've got 2 hours dedicated to it. I know for this board, that's a huge chunk of time to spend on a single issue, and pleased to see that. Specifically hope that as you come out of this discussion today, you have specific timelines and action plans, or at minimum, a process to make sure that in the future you have specific actions and timelines and looking for recommendations and actions from the staff in that regard. I would just mention 3 things very quickly that I would encourage you to look at as you evaluate what's going on with the owl and how you all can help to make that contribution for the recovery of the owl on non-federal lands. First is, are there additional interim protections that can and should happen for NSO or Northern Spotted Owl habitat that might be at risk in an interim period until you have a new management structure in place? And then second is making sure that there is a plan in place for a long-term strategy. Just as we need to have a long-term strategy on murrelets or other risk species, we need to have a long-term conservation strategy of how we approach this for the northern spotted owl. And a lot has changed since the species was first listed 20-plus years ago and since the board came up with its rules. So that'd be the first thing that I'd encourage you to do. Second is, as you're looking at that, there's a number of things that you should look at, both on the incentive side as well as the regulatory side. And there is a Northern Spotted Owl implementation team. You'll hear more about that. I serve on that. It's a wonderful process of trying to find ways for voluntary incentives for landowners to do more. And so make sure that's a key part of this, but also want to make sure that you look at the other array of options and tools that you have. And so that does mean looking at regulations. And that's not always something that is an easy consensus thing to rally around, but it is necessary to look at the current rules to see if they're structured the right way. What's in SOCI? What are the rules in SOCI? What's not in SOCIs? What are the rules for outside SOCIs? What are those boundaries? There's a lot of stuff that was set up back in 1997 that may or may not be the best approach going forward. And so we encourage you to make sure that whatever you do going forward, that you look at both that incentive side and the regulatory side. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean. Next commenter, Chris Mendoza. Morning, Chris.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Board. Today I'm going to speak to you on the handout that's provided by Jim Hotbed about the postmortem study. I think it starts, you've got a lot of handouts, there's a full deck over there, so it's the one that starts with, many of you probably saw the June article on the postmortem study. So if you don't have that in front of you, you might bring that up. So today, the purpose of my testimony is to sort of outline the process. I think that Jim Hotbed did a good job of laying out sort of a brief overview of where that study is. The last two paragraphs particularly, I think, sum up that it's in dispute resolution at this time at the policy level, which I will not be speaking to. Our policy rep will do that. So having said that, and in the interest of time, the only thing I'd like to add is that after being on CMER for, well, I guess, 8 years now, and being co-chair for the last 4 years, this is a first. I don't think I've seen a report go to policy in quite this way. What I want to do to help inform the board meeting is about how CMER process works. And that is that everyone comes, it runs on consensus, as you know, and once people agree to things, reports go to policy. Now, having said that, CMER also has a rules of engagement handbook, if you will. You can see it's pretty thick, and when you have a diverse group of people, such as we do, coming from all different stakeholder groups, you sort of need something like this to ensure that voices are heard and that people have sort of follow the rules of engagement. That way, everyone knows kind of what, you know, what's going on and how to move projects forward. Unfortunately, policy doesn't have such a booklet, and I'll leave it at that. But so for our purposes, when things don't get followed, sometimes you can get hung up. And I think in this case is probably the best example of where process steps were either skipped or not followed. And in those cases, then our process can get protracted and drug out over a long period of time. In fact, I think at your last meeting, you heard about the lean process and some of the outcomes of that on CMER's process, where they reviewed this. And I think the general consensus of the facilitator was that you guys have a lot of process steps, and let's eliminate some of those, probably speed things up. And he even spoke to potentially going to majority versus consensus. There's pros and cons with all of that. But my point being is that even if you go through that process, a lean, for example, and you eliminate a lot of those steps, we're still left with this. And so if board appointed CMER members can't follow this, then you're still going to end up in the same boat. And I think this is probably one of the best examples of having a process protracted to the point where there is no agreement on something, and the rules just kind of get tossed aside. So my advice as a co-chair is to make sure when you appoint members that they are aware of this, one, and two, that they follow it. And as co-chair, I do my best to attend all SAG meetings and, you know, and help members along to ensure that they do in fact know what's in here and they're aware of their votes and the rules of engagement that we have. If that's taken care of, then I think the lean process that we're going through will in fact help, and we can move, keep things moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Next commenter, Peter Goldman. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Board. I'm Peter Goldman, Washington Forest Law Center, representing the Conservation Caucus. I'm also the Conservation Caucus's policy representative at the Policy Committee. Two things this morning, actually three, one very short one. We'd like to congratulate and thank everybody for working collaboratively on the settlement agreement. I think it's a vote of confidence in science. Our caucus made the determination that this HCP is the foundation for a good plan. Through the settlement, I think we secured an adaptive management program that's going to be stable, well-funded, and hopefully will follow the science. And so I think Washington should be proud to have this HCP, but an HCP that's unfulfilled is not going to work. And that is the key here. And I think the board needs to really step up and supervise the implementation of this HCP, because an HCP in which any one party can interrupt or obstruct just by voting to break consensus is not going to work. So I think this board's duty now is going to be to step up and really watch what goes on in the process, because there are numerous paths that it could go down in the future. And so that sort of segues me into the post-mortem study. The state of Washington spent almost $2 million on this study. It basically studied the incidence of landslides in Southwest Washington after the storm. The study methodology was approved by numerous committees. It went through the science process for several years, as our letter, as our Conservation Caucus letter laid out. The report came back, again, went to the University of Washington, came back, and at the 11th hour, there was two of the caucuses basically broke consensus, challenging what we believe was a challenge to the methodology of the study. Our letter asked this board to make very clear statement that when we go through this process, spend all this money and all this time, one cannot challenge, or should not be able to challenge, the methodology of the study. It's one thing if the final study report doesn't accurately reflect something that's in the study itself. Certainly the final report should, should reflect what the findings of the study were. Those are editing errors, and we certainly understand that. But to the extent any caucus challenges the methodology of a study at the 11th hour, when we spend all this time and all this money, that's inappropriate, and we're asking the board's input on that today. There's numerous opportunities in the policy process for caucuses to say, well, the study stands for this or it doesn't stand for that, and there are numerous different ways the policy and the board can respond in terms of whether the rules should change and how. That's all fair game. Nothing prevents any party from arguing that, but if we can't get a science study to policy and onto this board, that's not a very good start after we sign the settlement agreement, and we would respectfully ask the board to become more involved in that. And then finally, on northern spotted owls, we signed a settlement agreement with the state 4 years ago, almost to this day. After a long, hard battle in federal court, in which a federal judge actually ordered an injunction against the Weyerhaeuser company for logging spotted owl habitat in Southwest Washington. Federal judge. The state said, we're going to work on the owl rules outside of SOCES. We formed an implementation committee, a technical committee, spent 4 years working on trying to do something, and we have nothing to show for it today. We've had since then a federal recovery plan that was once approved by the Bush administration, sent back, and now reissued by the Obama administration. It's been final now for 6 months or so. We have no response. We have no structure in place now to deal with this except for an implementation committee. We're asking for this board to form a subcommittee and finally take testimony on where we are with this and move on and make recommendations. Because, again, state and private lands do have a contribution to northern spotted owl recovery, and we have not got going on this. So we need to move, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter. Chip Peters. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
Good morning, Jim Peters, Northwest Indian Fish Commission and Squaxin Island Tribe Council. We support the same and have the same concerns that the Conservation Caucus has on the mass wasting study that has occurred. I would like that all of us respect the process that we have set up, and we have agreed, all of us have agreed to follow. It's concerning to the tribal governments that in 11th hour concerns can be brought up to stall a process, and that some of these concerns could have been brought up at the appropriate time for the caucuses to come in and change what the study was going to be about, what kind of questions, and so on and so forth. A lot of resources have been spent, a lot of time has been spent from all caucuses on this study. I think it was always a very important study that everybody agreed that we need to look at in light of those the massive storm that hit us in Southwest Washington. And that based on some of the findings that the study has shown, we really don't see that in some cases there possibly isn't going to be a rule change. There might be some manual changes, and maybe there's some suggestions of maybe our field people out in the field need a little more training to, identify some of the landforms out there. It's always a privilege and an honor to speak in front of this board. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. Next commenter, Kevin Gapu. Morning, Kevin.
Good morning. Good morning, board and members and chair. My name is Kevin Godwin. I'm with the Weyerhaeuser Company. I've got extensive involvement in both the key issues you're hearing this morning, postmortem and northern spot. And I'll start off on the Conservation Caucus's letter to the board. These issues have been raised time and again for 4 years. This business about 11th hour is misleading. The authors of the postmortem report are either unwilling or unable to address the substantial technical and scientific issues that have been brought before them. And basically what we have is a legitimate technical dispute, and what the letter attempts to do is reduce these important scientific issues to some form of quibbling over study design and process flaws. That simply misses the point. The board received that flawed historical summary in a request for guidance last Friday. If you're seeking an example of a process flaw, that letter is it. There are over 30 paragraphs in the Conservation Caucus letter to the board, and almost all of them are inaccurate in one way or another. And I think you cannot just decide to hide behind the process issues, because the scientific integrity of the program is really kind of at your control here. We went through an ISPR review process. Many ISPR reviewers brought up questions about the study design in their comments. One of them stated that, collective shortcomings are attributed in part to the study design and in part to the belief of the very large storm may have obscured subtle differences. Another ISPR reviewer talked about in the process weaknesses or inadequacy of the experimental design that may have caused the lack of statistical significance between various treatments that have been overlooked. So basically, you have a real legitimate technical and scientific dispute, and to try to just kind of ignore that and fall behind the facade of a process shield is not the way we should be implementing this program. In terms of the study design, the author said they would address issues regarding unequal risk and stand ages across treatment. They didn't do it. The study design was designed to examine how forest practices influence hill slope landslides, but the majority of the landslides occurred in riparian areas. The study was further designed to evaluate forest management influence on mass wasting processes. The PM authors changed the study's direction once they're in the field collecting data. So that's our main beef, is that we, sort of in a collegial way, sort of agree to a very conceptual study design, and then as it's being implemented in over time, there's pretty significant technical changes that get occurred, which then make it impossible in some cases to take what was, sort of as built or implemented in the field and relate it back to the study design. So we think those issues need to be part of this dispute resolution. We're working with the Conservation Caucus to see if we can resolve them. I have some faith in our ability to work through those. But for the board to unilaterally say that, people bought into this and it's done would be, incorrect. That doesn't reflect how CMER science works. We have a very collegial process. We have volunteer scientists. Remember, people are putting their own time in working through these issues. And in our case, one of our scientists did recognize and support moving some of the statistical design and study design issues forward. But, he did it with a caveat that there were still some issues that were outstanding, but they wanted to keep things moving. And so I think that's what you're dealing with. Are we going to approach sort of CMER science with lawyer-like efficiency on process steps? If we are, then we need a new process, because that's not how it works. We have people that are trying their best to come up with answers, and these are very difficult questions. So it may take more time, but I think you get a better project out of it. And I think that, you know, this is one in which we're going to need to keep working on, and I think you need to let policy see if we can pull, you know, some kind of rabbit out of the hat here, or we'll go to the next phase of dispute resolution, because this is too important an issue to not necessarily address. And I would say that I'm also a member of the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team.
Can I ask you to wrap it up?
Yeah, and I would just say we're very interested in working with the board and taking the Northern Spotted Owl implementation process and put it into action. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kevin. And our last person who signed up for comment this morning, Cindy Mitchell. Morning, Cindy.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the board. I'd like to make some remarks about the 10 a.m. agenda item, the Northern Spotted Owl Recovery. I just want to add a little bit of context and leave you with a one-page handout that Patricia's passing out right now. The reason it comes up today is that the federal government will make a decision in November about federal critical habitat that might evoke this board to take some action. It would be prudent to wait to see what the federal decision is before taking any action. We're special in the Northwest in that we have the most studied raptor in the world as part of our landscape, the Northern Spotted Owl. This means that the owl has gotten a lot of attention across the landscape in Oregon, Washington, and California from the scientific community. It has had the most impact on environmental policy of any bird or animal. It's shaped landscapes and communities. And we still are talking about the owl conservation 22 years later after its listing in 1990. Millions of acres across the landscape have been set aside in a three-state range, but the owl faces new challenges from its East Coast cousin, the barred owl, and unhealthy and fire-prone forests. You can just think of Colorado and the recent fires over in Kittitas County. In addition to the scientific community's focus, the owl regulations over the past two decades have gotten the attention of the president in Clinton's Northwest Forest Plan, Congress, federal agencies, state agencies such as this board, federal court, and state court. And in Washington, we spent nearly 4 years developing a comprehensive owl conservation strategy that the state's owl rule is a key part of that you hear more about today. In total, in Washington, nearly 13 million acres of the 17 million acres of forest in the Northern Spotted Owl's range has some sort of dedicated conservation strategy. This is across all landscapes, all ownerships. I'd like to close by saying that I think the most profound impact this bird has had in Washington is its ability to bring us together in a collaborative process to develop economic incentives for owl conservation. You'll hear more about the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team from Ann Hayes and Lauren Burns later today. It's clear that we have a lot of information, research, and experience with Northern Spotted Owl conservation. We also have a state process in place that takes a new approach, collaboration instead of contention. I urge you to keep this in mind as we wait for the federal government to make its final decision in November. It's also heartening to know that we're on the right track. The recent federal recovery plan supports both economic incentives and Recovery Action 15. You'll see that on the back of this handout. And it supports this board's process in Recovery Action 18. It encourages us to use the modeling and the recovery plan as information to inform the existing process. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cindy. That concludes testimony from all the people who have signed up. Is there anyone in the audience who did not sign up who'd like to provide comments to the board at this time? Bob.
Good morning. My name is Robert Meyer. I work for Rayonier. We manage 380,000 acres of timberlands on the coast of Washington. Again, I'd just like to urge the board to wait for federal decisions on the critical habitat designation before determining the direction to move. I'd also like the board to consider that there has been accomplishments relative to the spotted owl. The River and Habitat Program was adopted by the legislature, which came out of the first owl group that was commissioned by this board. And that program is ready and waiting for state funding. My understanding is the department is pushing to get funding into that program, and I would urge this board to support that funding. of the program that you manage. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. Carl? Good morning.
Good morning. Excuse me for limping. I pulled a muscle last night trying to play with fire. I am Obie O'Brien. I am Kittitas County Commissioner. And you may have heard this morning that we have over 26,000 acres on fire. We've lost over 60 structures. We have fire going towards the timber right now. If the wind changes or if the plan of the fire decides to eat the timber, you won't have an issue in Kittitas County. It'll just be smoke and ashes. What brings me here today, and planned to be here before this all started, was to just encourage you to keep in mind that every time you take out active logging and management out of a forest, you make it unhealthy. We have a massive amount of bug kill between the spruce budworm and the bark beetles that are just killing off large amounts of the forest. The top third of most of the trees are dead, and they're standing dead fuel, and the fire that we have right now is likely to take out all of that unless God decides to be very merciful. So the reason that I am just kind of bringing this up now is in case anyone had any interest about what's going on there at Kittitas County. But the other part is just to encourage you to keep in mind that the only thing that will save the environment is actively getting rid of the bugs, actively thinning out the forests by logging and other active management that will bring it back to a healthy environment. It has been mismanaged at best, poorly managed, most likely, and ignored for many, many, many years. And so we are sitting in a situation that will go off like many of the houses that just blew up last night. And I left the emergency operating center at 1 a.m., tried to get a couple hours of sleep before hitting a 6 a.m. briefing with DNR this morning, and then came on over here to enjoy your general people's presence. So if there's anything I can learn, that's why I came here, and anything I can share back with you, it would be a serious concern that spotted owl and forest mismanagement has done almost as much damage to our county and many counties in Washington as the Department of Ecology is turning off the water spigot and not allowing us to drill wells. So there's just a tremendous amount of economic and personal impact on the decisions you make, and I just would love to be able to interface with you in any way I can to kind of help keep that as a part of this discussion. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, Mark.
Thank you for coming and giving us a bit of an update. I certainly wish the county and DNR success in getting this fire out. A couple of years ago, the board had a tour into the Tiananmen Valley, and we talked about forest health issues and spotted owls and a number of other things that were very appropriate for that area. Is that particular area involved in the fire at this time?
It is not at this moment. The winds are blowing it away from the Tiananmen Valley, the upper North Fork and the West Fork of the Tiananmen. However, that is the area that is of primary concern. Then the second area of concern is the wind is pushing the fire towards the Clockham, which is the northeastern end of the county. And that is one of the two largest elk herds in all of the state of Washington. If that goes, it will go all the way to the Columbia River, and we won't have that fire under control until the second big snow. Any other questions? Thank you, sir, for that.
Thank you.
And thank you for your time.
Is there anyone else who would like to provide comment to the board? Okay. That concludes our public comment segment and moves us on to staff reports. And as is the board's practice, staff have submitted their written reports that are in board packets. And this is the opportunity for board members to call upon staff if you have questions you'd like to have answered or comments you'd like to make on a particular report that's been provided to you. Norm?
Given the testimony that we heard largely this morning, it might be appropriate to hear a little bit more from Jim Hodda regarding the postmortem study and dispute resolution from the staff perspective.
Jim, would you be able to come up and give us a short status report on where things stand?
Yeah.
Good morning, members of the board. My name is Jim Hodbett, and I'm the Adaptive Management Program Administrator. So the report came from the SEMR co-chairs to policy. I might get my month wrong, but I believe it was May. And the request, the basically the co-chair sent it over as a final report. The WFPA representing the landowners requested dispute resolution, believing that the report shouldn't go to policy for any kind of decision making or discussion until technical issues were resolved or scientific issues were resolved. So the co-chairs and I came up with a recommended process for dealing with the dispute. We presented it to policy in July, and we had consensus on the process. Unfortunately, as in my memo or email to you, the person that would have helped us try to resolve the dispute was not available and wasn't going to be available in the future. The policy co-chairs and I then came up with a second recommendation that was presented to policy 2 weeks ago. And my understanding, I wasn't at the policy meeting, my understanding was that there was a consensus by all but one of the caucuses on the recommendation, and that the representative of that caucus had to go back to their caucus in order to determine whether or not they could agree to what came out of the discussion at policy, and that person was supposed to get back to the policy co-chair sometime, I believe, this week. So where we stand now is trying to come up with another process on how to deal with the dispute.
Jim, could you refresh the board on how the dispute resolution process works, the timelines and the two stages and what happens at each stage?
Right, okay. So we have three stages. The stages are stage one, stage two, stage three. The first two stages are stages that would be stay within policy. So we have 6 months in stage one to try to resolve the dispute. If it's not resolved in stage one, then a participant can request that the dispute then go to what's called stage two. And in stage two, we would either use a mediator or an arbitrator. An arbitrator meaning that a final decision would be recommended by the arbitrator. If it's not resolved, if instead we use mediation and there's still no resolution even through stage two, then stage three is the issue coming to the board for resolution. Now we have 6 months for stage one and 3 months for stage two. And we're currently, I believe, 3 months into stage one.
So what would be the possible outcomes if dispute resolution is not successful in phase one?
Either going to stage two or coming to the board.
Directly.
Would be the outcomes, right.
Norm, you had a follow-up?
Just to thank you, Chair. Make sure that I was clear. From what I can gather from your comments, it sounds like you would say you're not at an impasse at this point. You're still seeking to work through the established process within the established time frame, the 6 months before. And hopefully it doesn't get there, going to stage two of the dispute resolution process.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. I'd say we are not at an impasse unless you define impasse as a short-term, temporary, we haven't come up with that process yet.
No, I don't define it as that. Because when people just refuse to even talk about it anymore,
right.
That's impasse.
We are not at an impasse.
Okay.
Policy is not at an impasse.
Okay.
I don't believe.
Thank you.
Bill?
So, a couple questions and then a hypothetical. We heard that one caucus believes that this is, going back and challenging study methodology,
mm-hmm.
which, if I understand the process, that's sort of not what the process is intended to do. And then there's the other caucus, which says that there are technical challenges. So is that, which they're saying are legitimate reasons mm-hmm. to do this. So, first of all, is that an accurate interpretation of what we heard from the two sides, which is why we're at this dispute resolution?
to say they're both right. My personal opinion, as the AMPA, trying to remain neutral and not take sides, I think they're both right. And the reason I say that they're both right is that the issue's not over all over methodology. Some is over interpretation of the results. And the ISPR reviewers were concerned about the interpretation of the results. And so that's a very legit, post-ISPR, after it comes back from ISPR, and CMER's trying to figure out how to respond to ISPR comments. Those remain legitimate issues if CMER members don't believe that the ISPR reviewers' comments have been appropriately addressed. So I think the problem becomes is that the minority reports are, I haven't added them all up, but I would guess there's about 20 pages in the minority reports. And so it basically comes down to going down to each item on every page and trying to figure out, is this one a process file as it might be characterized, or is it legitimate? And I think going through that process would be very timely and very difficult. Now, on the other hand, my understanding from what I've heard in the last 2 days is that's kind of the process. I might be putting words into their mouths, but my understanding is that's exactly what I think the Landowner Caucus and the Conservation Caucus has agreed to do, to try to sift through those differences. So I got to look and make sure I'm not mischaracterizing what they've been talking about.
So my hypothetical is, what if, it sounded like we had 6 months left about for dispute resolution.
Unless the parties agree to,
but it
the thing is the parties agree to extend the timeline.
Let's say there's 6 months. So what happens if there's a huge storm while this is in dispute and we have a major problem? I mean, are we vulnerable to public ridicule and our ability to move this thing forward in a way that, you know, prevents something from happening that could have been prevented if we can speed up this process?
I think I'd leave that up to the agencies and the caucuses and the
policy folks. From a purely regulatory standpoint, the current rules prevail until such time as if and when the board were to change those rules.
And changing the rules is going to take.
I'm not talking about changing the rules. I'm just talking about getting to where we're not in dispute resolution when another storm hits, and where we could have advanced the ball before the storm season.
Dave?
Question.
So it's a policy decision whether or not they're going to go to stage two or ask for
yes.
us?
Yes.
Just a comment, I guess. It's kind of a half-cooked egg at this point, and I'm not sure what direction we give, since we do have a process we'll eventually get it here. But I'm really concerned if we have created a process where we could spend millions of dollars and go several years down the road in a study and get to a point where things could just be stopped on issues that should have been raised. It should have probably stopped this study early on if that's the case. And, so that's a general concern that I don't think our CMER process will work if we create that kind of situation or allow that to happen. Now, whether you buy the results or not, whether you agree with them, you know, I think that gets to an implementation question and a debate that can happen after that. So I think we need to tease those two issues apart, but I'm very concerned that if we do have a system now that we can say it was wrong from the start,
yeah,
it's not going to work. But I'm also a little concerned about sending it to the board when trying to settle technical issues and results. We've been there before, very difficult and awkward. So I guess I would encourage the caucuses to sort through this. It gets very messy when you send technical issues to a policy board. So that's just some comments.
I think the comment on that is I think there's agreement also among some, at least, policy members that that technical issues oughtn't be raised in policy either, that rather they ought to be back in the science community and in CMER in particular.
Okay. Jim, just a follow-up on Phil's question. I understand we have 6 months in stage one for dispute resolution?
A total, unless others, yes.
Unless others. We're partly through stage one right now. So how many more months are there before stage one would conclude?
If I did my math right, just three.
Okay, so something will happen within 3 months, hopefully sooner than that?
Yeah.
So I still feel like there's disagreement over the characterization about how the process is working, and I want to see if we can tease that out a little bit, because it seems to be an important issue.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to run through a couple of things and you know, try to get confirmation on what happened or not. So the study design was approved by both CMR and policy.
So I wasn't around. A study design was approved by CMR and policy.
Okay.
A study design. I want to use A rather than the.
Okay. So and the report came back, and CMR voted to move it on to the ISPR process.
Yes.
It went to ISPR. And ISPR had comments.
Yes.
The study authors, or let's see if I understand correctly, the various committees of CMR established a matrix that dealt with the comments from ISPR, mm-hmm. and dealt with the process for dealing with those comments. The study authors made extensive revisions to the report based on the comments. Is that true?
Yes.
So is where we are then that some members of CMR don't feel like the authors adequately addressed comments within the matrix?
Yes.
So, and then the letter from the Conservation Caucus makes it sound as if there were comments that were not in the matrix, and those were the ones that weren't adequately addressed, but the ones inside the matrix were actually addressed.
Now, whether that's fair or not, I can't answer, because I wasn't at UPSAG when they went through the matrix, and whether they agreed or disagreed as members of UPSAG to only look at those in the matrix or others, I don't know. Or whether somebody had to go through the list of comments and decide whether they were the matrix bin or they were outside the matrix. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the discussion was or the agreement was as to the separation and how accurate the separation was.
Okay.
That's where I really got to be careful.
All right. But I think the impression that I'm left with as a board member is that an enormous amount of time and effort has gone into this study.
Yes.
And there was a lot of time and effort on the part of the study authors to address everybody's comments.
Yes.
And so I'm a little bit concerned that we have a process in which we still end up at dispute resolution after all of that effort's gone into it. And so I think my basic question is, are there reforms to the process or to the way that CMR functions that need to be made in order to prevent that kind of, for lack of a better word, mess from occurring again? This does not look like a smooth process. This does not look like how things should function, especially since there were several process steps that were passed along the way. So just from your perspective, mm-hmm. as the administrator of this program, do you see things that could have been done differently, either within current process, or do you see changes to the process that are needed, either that are going to be recommended as part of the settlement or part of lien, that would prevent this sort of thing from happening again?
That's a tough question. You know, like with lien, I'm going to use lien. Lien, you know, we came up with a process that we want to pilot. We don't know if that'll work or not. It may work and it may not. If it doesn't work, then we go back and try to revise some other revision of our current process. If it does work, then we take and revise our current process. In this case, when response matrices are developed, in many cases, the direction to the authors is fairly general. It's not real clear. Please respond to, you know, A, B, and C, but it doesn't say in the matrix literally what the wording would be that would go into the final report. So when the authors then take what's in the matrix as a direction and then they revise the final report, will all senior members agree that they revised it appropriately based on the matrix?
And in this case, there were a lot of comments that were very general in terms of, we will respond to that comment, ISBR comment. But they weren't specific about how the authors were going to respond to it. And that's where I say that, personally, that maybe some of the concerns by the SEBR members mentioned are still legitimate. Because there wasn't agreement of SAG or CMR when the ISBR response matrix was approved on specifically how the authors would revise the document. And so that's open for, how they revised it would be open for review. Now, the way journal articles authors normally operate when they get a manuscript back from a journal is that they would review the reviewer's comments, basically try to bucket whatever the comments are, and then they would revise the document. And when after the document's revised, then they would go through and say, okay, I changed these things based on ISBR reviewer comments, and I didn't change these things, and here's why I didn't change those things. So basically, it's like developing the response matrix after the revision so that you're specifically clear about what you revised and didn't revise and why, as opposed to what CMR does, which is develop the matrix comment or the comment matrix before the revision. And I personally think if they did it after the revision, that it would be more clear what got changed, what didn't get changed, and why. But that's, again, a personal opinion, and it might work and it might not work.
Okay. Don't drag this out too long, but at some point, the study is the report of the authors.
Yes.
There has to be a termination, and they don't have to agree with all the comments or respond. At some point, you've got to move on and say, we don't agree with this conclusion for this reason. If somebody's on the outside that's not part of the study, say, we don't agree with that. But the study is complete, and so that's what I guess why I'm concerned is we need to be have a clear point. I like your suggestion of, you know, would have been maybe clearer to tie up the loose ends for the authors to say, this is what we responded to, this is what we did, and why. That's probably a useful thing maybe for the dispute resolution. But at some point, you know, the study is what the study is, and you can't make the authors really change their interpretation. So I think we need a clear breakpoint.
Yeah, I call that the discretion of the authors, and I agree with you. I think especially on issues of style, writing style, things like that, that they're out to be given, the authors ought to be given more discretion. Because the CMR, I mean, think about, they're scientists, they're detail people. They comment on everything. And I often believe that there ought to be given some discretion to the authors in some areas.
Okay, any further questions for Jim?
No. Discussion item, not really to Jim. Is that appropriate at this point?
Maybe we could, is there anything else for Jim? Then we could move on with the rest of our staff reports.
Well, it's discussion about this report. And I don't know if you wanted to bring that up at another time.
Okay, we can go ahead and take that now.
Okay. Yeah, not specifically to Jim.
Jim, why don't you hang up there, though, in case we need your reply.
I would just encourage that for all of the caucuses and people that come to these meetings and present things for potential board action, getting material to us more than a day in advance of the actual meeting would be helpful. I received this letter yesterday, so it was the first chance I had to read it. And obviously, it's a complex issue. Without giving merit to one side or the other, there are many sides, many issues. And Jim had prepared a letter in a staff report that gave us one aspect of it, and then we heard another larger description of what might have been involved, and then we heard more in testimony. So again, I would just encourage for all caucuses that materials such as this, especially where they're asking for board direction, which is what the letter from the Conservation Caucus seemed to imply, that we have a little bit more advanced opportunity for that. It would be very helpful for our consideration.
I think I would note, too, that we have some opportunity queued up to make changes to the adaptive management program pursuant to the settlement agreement, and our next agenda item is a update from you and Mark on the adaptive management review process, the lean process that you've went through, and those may represent opportunities to fix things that could work better than they are now. Okay. Other questions on staff reports before we move on to the lean process update? Okay. So our next agenda item, Jim, I'm going to call you right back up with to give us an update on your lean review.
Okay, if you recall, David Howe from Strategica presented a report on a lean exercise that he conducted for the adaptive management program at your request last year, I believe last November, at your November meeting. And he helped Seamer come up with a recommended new process that he recommended to pilot it for developing scoping documents and study designs. And at the conclusion of the report, the board requested that Seamer try to take any new projects coming up and to pilot the recommendation on those projects. So what Mark and I are doing is reporting on status to date on developing a using the new lean approach for projects. We do have one that Seamer has already approved. We talked to the SAG, Mark talked to the Eastside Scientific Advisory Group, or what we call SAGE. They agreed to release a project, Eastside Type N Buffer Effectiveness Project, to this lean approach. And we already have recommended TWIG, which is all the acronyms, Technical Writing and Implementation Group. It's an initial writing group that would start with a draft scoping document. And we're in the process now. I've got the approval from the supervisors and of those folks, and now all we have to do is get Seamer approval of, there's two of them, of the two people, and then they can begin to develop a draft scoping document. So now we're in the process of looking for other projects, and I'm going to let Mark talk about the process he's going through for finding other projects beside the Eastside Type N Effectiveness Project.
For the record, I'm Mark Hicks. I work with the Department of Ecology as a forestry water quality coordinator, and I'm currently serving as co-chair of CEMER. We did a multi-stakeholder process to develop the concept of these technical writing and implementation groups, and the acronym just seemed to fit. So yes, we went for the acronym. We took the results of that. In fact, the contractor came with us the first time to Seamer to explain to the larger body of Seamer what had done, what we had gone through, and what we were going to try to test run and pilot. We then discussed that with individual SAGs, because not all members of the SAGs come to the Seamer meetings. And I would characterize the response as cautious support. People understand that our existing process is a little cumbersome and it's not really working for everybody. Or actually, it's not really working for anybody. But like anything, people are a little reluctant to let go of something they're familiar with and they at least understand. So there's this cautious moving forward. But I'd say we've had pretty much good support all across Seamer for being willing to try this out and see if it works, just as long as we can back out if it doesn't work. Okay, so that's where we're at the moment. So when we were looking at possible projects to pilot, you know, originally we came to the board, we suggested three projects, but we realized that we probably better be looking at our full list of potential projects. And the way we did that was to look at what we currently have prioritized for funding in the next 2 years, plus what you will see as priority projects for the settlement agreement, which they dovetail really, really tightly except for one project. So they're essentially the same thing. So we looked at the projects that we would be starting, you know, essentially in this next 2 years, as the ones that we would probably consider for piloting the twig. So rather than trying to look at just those three, we look more broadly, because one of the considerations we have to think about is what capacity we have, and that's the capacity of our project managers, the which we have one of right now, the capacity of our SEMR staff, as well as what our senior scientists within SEMR, the more experienced folks, how is their workload working right now? Do they have the ability to take on other work? And since they specialize in different areas, you have to look at each potential project in terms of, do we have the necessary technical and support team necessary to start that project as a twig or any other way, even through the traditional SAG process right now? And when we do that, we come up with five potential projects. The first one was the one that Jim noted, which is the Eastside Type-In Effectiveness Study. Also, and I'm running down kind of generally in priority because of when they're coming due, the Forested Wetland Effectiveness Study, Unstable Slopes Criteria Evaluation and Development, Road Prescription Scale Effectiveness Monitoring, and a Westside Type F Riparian Prescription Scale Monitoring Project. That's the one that's kind of, I'll call it the oddball. That's the one that wasn't originally a priority, but rose as a priority as part of the settlement agreement. Okay, but the other four are actually, they've been our priorities for a long time, and they've been scheduled for funding. So those are our likely candidates. And essentially, SEMR's not going to start any new projects independent of considering whether it should go through this twig process. So all of our near-term projects, that's what we're going to do. We'll be evaluating whether we have the teams internally, in whole or in part. I say in part because some of our studies go out to external contracting. And so we would use a twig to get the process begun, but we'd have to build in through hiring on contractors to actually follow through the implementation phase too. And that includes when we're doing study designs. We often contract out for the study design itself. So we'll probably have a chance to test this twig process in a couple different ways, where SEMR fully staffs the entire development of the study design, and where SEMR basically scopes what the study needs to do, and then essentially manages the contracting to an external entity to actually develop the study design. And that's good, because that is the way we do our business. We don't do it all ourselves in-house. So that's where we're going at this point and some of our considerations.
Questions for Jim or Mark?
I was reviewing the handout that was in the board pack. This is from the May meeting. And it talked about the twigs as being maybe four members kind of maximum. Look like, which could be a significant difference from the various SAGs that may have a lot more members and may be designed to represent every single aspect of all the different caucuses. How does the process that you're proposing now ensure the appropriate scientific and technical expertise within the group, as well as the broad base and the collaborative process that we're trying to achieve without overburdening the size of these groups?
Well, I mean, the whole idea of the twig is to begin with a charter about that includes the steps of what is the key technical expertise we need to do this particular project. So it begins with, it could start with just two people, let's say, one or two people, to begin the process rolling, and we add to it to get to the full twig later on. If we find there's a missing expertise, part of the twig process is to identify that gap and to fill it either internally or through external consulting, but to still keep the twig itself fairly small with people who are capable of doing the work, moving it through to the study design phase. And we've learned that smaller groups work more effectively together, more time efficiently together than the larger groups do. There is always some give and take as far as what you get out of any kind of a change in a program. Ours is this idea is to move quickly through those initial stages developing a draft, but then it moves into the full SEMR review process with all the stakeholders. So it's really getting us through those first steps to have something for SEMR to review quicker. That's one of the main benefits of where we're going, And something that relates back to the conversation you were having previously with the postmortem dispute is that the part of this lien process also moves us through the initial ISBR on the study design. It's a different process for ISBR, where we're putting more weight back on the ISBR reviewers to actually tell us whether we've met their comments, we've addressed their comments effectively or not. So instead of creating a matrix that essentially goes to CMER to decide whether we met the ISBR comments, we're actually going to put together a revised draft and a matrix that, this is our vision at this point, we haven't tested it, that would then go back to the associated editor to determine whether in fact the ISBR comments were made. Were addressed appropriately. So there's a number of improvements to the system that we're trying to make that should speed it along and keep the scientific integrity high.
Follow up by me.
Yes. Is my understanding correct that then for every project that moves forward, there would be a TWIG established for that project?
Yes, that's
so
correct.
Rather than sort of the standing committees that you have now, you'd have a small group for each individual project.
Yes.
Thank you.
Other questions for Mark or Jim? Okay, let's go ahead and take a short recess, and we'll convene promptly again at 10:15.